Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Friday, January 15th, 2021. Section A. Board makes California leader its superintendent pick. Unanimously approved, lone finalist was leader in an El Paso area district by Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HearstMP.com. The Midland Independent School District Board selected Angelica Ramsey of Pleasant Valley School District in Camarillo, California, as the lone finalist for the permanent superintendent position. Ramsey has served as the superintendent of schools at the Southern California District since July 2016, according to that district's website. The following is what that district's website states about Ramsey. Under her leadership, PVSD created and published a three-year strategic plan entitled Vision 2020, Excellence for All. The plan outlined newly formulated goals, articulated commitments aligned to LCAP priorities, and identified specific strategies to meet the goals. We are very excited by what Dr. Ramsey can bring to our district, and we look forward to her joining in our mission to ensure all students are prepared and ready for college or career, said Rick Davis, board president. All board members are thoroughly impressed with Dr. Ramsey's track record of academic improvement, and we feel she will be a great fit not only for our district, but in the Midland community. According to our district's website, Ramsey also led Pleasant Valley School District as it published a master facilities plan, which led to a successful $119 million school bond measure to ensure 21st century learning environments, upgrades to aging infrastructure, and implementation of safety measures. Ramsey was unanimously approved as the lone finalist during a special meeting of the board Thursday evening. The meeting followed three other meetings this week with applicants brought back for second interviews. I am excited and honored to be joining the Midland ISD team, Ramsey said in a statement. I look forward to meeting with and learning from the board, our students, teachers, staff, and the entire community as we work to build a new era of excellence. The school board must now wait 21 days before approving a contract with Ramsey, according to state law, but if approved, Ramsey will be the first female superintendent in the history of the school district. A date has not been set for the vote. The selection followed around 90 minutes of discussion about the chief executive officer of the school district and person to replace Orlando Riddick, who resigned last fall. Ramsey's LinkedIn page also showed more than 4 years of experience at the Santa Clara County Office of Education, including 3 years as chief academic officer and 1 year as associate superintendent. Prior to that, she was a principal for 2.5 years in Socorro in the El Paso area. Groups listed on her LinkedIn page include Great Schools, Instructional Leadership Coaching and Development, National Hispania Leadership Institute, STEAM Education, Educating Black Children, and K-12 BYOD. Ramsey holds a bachelor degree from the University of the Pacific, a master's degree from the University of Texas at El Paso, and a doctorate in educational leadership from Liberty University. FBI documents, Cudd and Rosa, seen on Capitol security footage. By Caitlin Randall, C-R-A-N-D-L-E at MRT.com. A criminal complaint for Midlanders Jenny Cudd and Ilya Rosa shows the FBI's case against them is based on security footage inside the Capitol building and their own social media posts. Cudd, a Midland businesswoman, and Rosa, an asylee from Brazil, were charged with two misdemeanors Wednesday for their roles in the riots that broke out on Capitol Hill a week earlier. They each face up to a year and a half in prison for charges of entering and remaining on restricted grounds and disorderly conduct or violent entry. Rioters broke through barriers and began advancing toward the exterior of the building about 2 p.m. on January 6th, according to the complaint and attached statement facts. The documents state that at about 2:20 p.m., lawmakers were instructed to evacuate the House and Senate chambers after rioters forced entry into the Capitol by breaking windows and assaulting police officers. Cudd and Rosa are then seen on security footage entering the building through the West Terrace doors at 2:35 p.m., according to the complaint. Over the next 20 minutes, security cameras captured them taking pictures inside the Capitol Rotunda, walking in the Statuary Hall portion of the building, and near entrances to the House chamber before leaving. The complaint does not allege that the two Midlanders entered the House or Senate floors or any lawmakers' offices, despite a viral Facebook live video in which Cudd says, "We did break down Nancy Pelosi's office door and somebody stole her gavel." Cudd said in an interview with the Reporter Telegram the day after the riots that she used the term "we" to refer to the actions of the group and not her own involvement. In addition to security footage, the FBI's evidence also comes from Cudd's social media posts during and after the riots, according to the complaint. In one of the videos referenced, Cudd says, "We just pushed and yelled go and yelled charge, and we got in." The documents also note Cudd's apparent lack of remorse following her participation in the riots, including her statement in a Facebook video that, "F blank blank yes, I am proud of my actions. I F blank 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 charged the Capitol today with patriots. Hell yes, I am proud of my actions." An interview with television station KOSA on January 8th, in which Cudd said, "I would absolutely do it again," is also referenced in the complaint. The documents state that Rosa was interviewed by FBI investigators on January 8th and allegedly admitted he and Cudd had entered the Capitol building. Despite Cudd's assertion in interviews with news outlets that she didn't do anything unlawful by entering the Capitol building, the complaint states that both the plaza and interior of the Capitol were closed to the public on January 6th during the joint session of Congress. It also notes that those who entered the Capitol did so without the required security screenage and weapons checks. Cudd and Rosa face up to a year in prison on the entering restricted grounds charge, a Class A misdemeanor, as well as a $100,000 fine and up to a year of supervised release. On the disorderly conduct charge, a Class B misdemeanor, they face up to 6 months in prison. Blue Origin launches capsule to space with astronaut perks, by Marcia Dunn from the Associated Press. Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin company launched a new capsule into space Thursday to test all the astronaut perks before people strap in. Thursday's flight with a dummy named Mannequin Skywalker lasted 10 minutes and reached 66 miles above West Texas. Both the New Shepard rocket and the capsule landed successfully. It was the 14th flight to the fringes of space for the New Shepard rocket. First was in 2015. "The success of this flight puts us one really big step closer to flying astronauts," launch commentator Ariane Cornell said from company headquarters in Kent, Washington. "There's going to be a lot of fun ahead in 2021. Blue Origin plans to launch paying passengers, tourists, scientists, and professional astronauts on brief hops over West Texas's remote desert. It's also working on a bigger rocket, New Glenn, that would blast off from Cape Canaveral, as well as a lunar lander for astronauts under NASA's Artemis moon program. The capsule soaring Thursday featured the latest crew upgrades: microphones and push-to-talk buttons for the 6 seats, wall panels to muffle engine noise, a safety alert system, and temperature and humidity controls to keep passengers comfortable and the big windows free of fog. The launch and landing team was scaled back because of the pandemic. New Shepard is named for the first American in space, Alan Shepard. New Glenn honors John Glenn, the first American in orbit. City reports 202nd death, nearly 14,700 total COVID cases. from staff reports. The city of Midland reported the 202nd death of a Midland County resident because of COVID-19 issues during the pandemic. The city reported a man in his 80s passed away December 16th. He was being treated at Legacy Ranch. The death was the 17th reported this month. Other numbers reported include 95 unconfirmed cases Wednesday, according to the Midland Health Department. Those cases brought the total for the week to 278. Those in January increased to 1,170. There have been 14,694 cases during the pandemic. Midland Health on its website Thursday showed 153 positive tests this week and positivity rate of 22%.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Friday, January 15, 2021. Swinging in the Shine. Gabby Rivera and her niece, Adelina Bryan, swing together and enjoy the sun shining and slightly warmer temperatures Tuesday afternoon at Dennis the Menace Park. Midland Livestock Show Schedule. The Midland County Livestock Show is taking place this week at the Horseshoe. Events continue today and Saturday. Today's schedule includes the Market Goat Show at 8 a.m. That show will be followed by the Breeding Goat Show and Market Lamb Show. The Heifer Show begins at 1 p.m., followed by the Steer Show. The Horse Show is slated to begin at 5 p.m. On Saturday, judging of the culinary arts begins at 10 a.m. The barbecue dinner takes place at 11 a.m., as does the 500 Club Invitational Luncheon. At 12:45 p.m., the Pee Wee Goat Show will take place, followed by the premium auction sale and awards at 1:10 p.m. Source, Midland County Livestock Association. Midland Chamber gets 4-star accreditation. The United States Chamber of Commerce has awarded the Midland Chamber of Commerce with 4-star accreditation for its sound policies, effective organizational procedures, and positive impact on the Midland community, according to a news release from the Midland Chamber. This is the second highest accreditation level that can be achieved by a chamber. "Our team is thrilled to receive this honor," said Bobby Burns, Midland Chamber President and CEO. "We thank our members and our community for allowing us to serve our city as the leading voice of business." The Midland Chamber reports 3% of chambers across the country are accredited. To receive accreditation, a chamber must meet minimum standards in its operations and programs, including areas of governance, government affairs, and technology. This extensive self-review can take 6 to 9 months to complete. Source, Midland Chamber of Commerce. Watering schedule. The City of Midland has adjusted the lawn and landscaping watering schedule, which will allow residents to water 4 days a week instead of two. Even-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and odd-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. How sick are you? Midland Memorial Hospital offers a nurse triage program, 68 Nurse. The program is designed to help people determine whether their health situation warrants a trip to the emergency room. Midland residents can call the line by dialing 686-8773. The program is free and available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Local nurses are available to help you determine the best place to receive care for your situation. 68 Nurse can help you save time and money by directing you to the most appropriate health care option, whether it's a neighborhood clinic, urgent care center, emergency room, or just staying home. Contact your representative. State Senator Kel Seliger, Republican. Address, State Capitol, Room GE4, Austin, Texas, 78701. Phone, 512-463-0131. Fax, 563-0653. Midland Office Address, 6 Desta Drive, Suite 3360, Midland, Texas, 79705. Phone, 620 0436. Website, senate.state.us/75r/senate/members/dist31/dist31.htm. Facebook, www.facebook.com/SenatorKelSeliger.
The Opinion Page. Opinion Extra from Ben Shapiro. Lies tearing America apart are told by both parties. Last week, the Capitol was breached by a group of fringe Trump supporters who had bought into a series of lies. The lie that President Donald Trump lost the election due to proven voter fraud and irregularity. The lie that the Electoral College results, legally certified state by state, could be overturned by Congress or the Vice President. The lie that Trump would remain in office if only some sort of armed rebellion were to prevent the election certification by Congress. Those were lies. And those lies had deadly consequences. Thankfully, the vast majority of Americans don't believe those lies, which means we should be able to unify around certain basic truths: that Joe Biden is legally president-elect of the United States, that violence in pursuit of political ends is a deep wrong, and those who participate in it should be punished to the full extent of the law, and that broad claims regarding invasion of rights ought to be backed up by compelling evidence. But we won't. That's because while the Democratic Party and the political left agree that Joe Biden is president-elect, they absolutely disagree with both the fundamental precept that violence in pursuit of political ends is a deep wrong, and the even more fundamental precept that claims require evidence. We saw that this summer, when Democratic Party officials made light of riots spreading across the nation in the name of yet another lie, that lie that America is systemically racist, rooted in slavery and Jim Crow, and replete with bigoted police dedicated to endangering black lives. Democrats demanded no evidence to support those claims. In knee-jerk fashion, they simply repeated ad nauseum untruths about the existential threat to black Americans in the United States. Which means that for the Democrats and the political left, violence is fine so long as it supports their narrative, and unevidenced claims are fine so long as they support an agenda. In order to defend such violence, the political left has mobilized behind another convenient and advantageous lie, the lie that the Capitol riots represent all conservatives and Republicans. Paul Krugman of the New York Times suggested that the push was decades in the making, chalking up the rioting to Republican elites since before Ronald Reagan. The Washington Post amplified a nutty post from the chairman of the Nye County Republican Party in Nevada into a referendum on a long-festering struggle within the Republican Party over the conspiracy theories, purity tests, and fealty to the rule of law. Members of the media gleefully hunted for Republicans to blame for the Capitol riots, calling for the deplatforming of brand-name conservatives and cheering on social media crackdowns. Lies are dangerous, and double standards are perhaps the most dangerous form of lying. They grant the bravery of purity to those most willing to defy decency, prompting similar spasms of cruelty and malice from the other side. The solution to our national crisis of conscience isn't bad faith political purges or repetition of tiresome falsehoods about the nature of the United States. It's truth. But truth is more a shield than a sword, and we are now in the age of swords, wielded aggressively by those with little principle but an unending sense of their own moral superiority. Obituaries and death notices. Louis John Bevacqua, Jr., formerly of Midland, passed away in Las Cruces on December 30th. A memorial mass will be planned for a later date in Las Cruces due to COVID pandemic concerns. Any donations in his memory should be directed to the American Volksport Association, San Antonio, Texas, Catholic Charities, or charity of your choice. Jane Majors, 98, of Midland, passed away January 13th. Funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. Monday, January 18th, at Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home Chapel, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Online condolences may be made at www.mpwelsh.com. Leopoldo Equinones, 64, Midland, passed away January 13th. Private family services will be held at Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland. Online condolences may be made at mpwelsh.com.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Friday, January 15th, 2021. Section A. Teachers given ways to navigate riot discussion. Tools provided to help address students' concerns, by Ruth Campbell. After the events of January 6th, when Trump supporters rioted at the nation's capital, Ector County ISD Superintendent Scott Murray said teachers were given information and tools to help answer students' questions. In a media call Wednesday, Murray said they anticipated questions from primarily middle and high school students, but some elementary as well. We knew there would be questions and thoughts and ideas that kids would want to share. We didn't want our teachers to be caught off guard, so last week we sent an email that contained some resources and tools for our teachers. We sent that to all of our administrators so they could share that with their teachers. That was Wednesday night. So when our teachers came to work Thursday morning, they were armed and ready to deal with any questions or thoughts or concerns that students may have, Murray said. The most likely spot for those conversations would have been social studies or history classes, but Murray said they knew those discussions were just as likely to happen in a math or science class. So we equipped all of our teachers with information so that they could address and listen to the concerns of their students, and we'll continue to do so. In fact, any time there is a national or international event that we feel might create significant conversations in our schools, we want to make sure our teachers are equipped with the resources they need to engage in conversations. So we will always do that, he added. As opposed to promoting one side or another, Murray said it was listening and guiding students in conversations. In speech and debate, for example, he said they educate students on how to have civil discourse. We can agree on topics, but in conversations we can agree to disagree, or we can discuss in a very civilized way the differences that we have. We want to make sure that we equip our students with the tools that they need to engage in civil discourse, and our teachers are ready to do that, Murray said. On a separate topic, Murray said the ECISD Board of Trustees January 12th heard about an opportunity to partner with the Odessa Family YMCA to serve three-year-old pre-kindergarten students starting in August 2021. We know that educating children as soon as we possibly can contributes to their lifelong learning opportunities, and we're excited to announce that we will be providing a pre-K program to our three-year-olds starting in August of 2021. Unfortunately, we're not able to handle all of those three-year-olds on our own, so we solicited assistance for an organization that could partner with us in the education of our three-year-old kids. After an exhaustive search and looking through a variety of applications, we have selected the YMCA as our partner in this work, Murray said. The partnership was sought under State Senate Bill 1882 because the school district does not have the capacity to educate those 1,000 three-year-old pre-kindergarten students. He noted that the agreement is not yet finalized. Currently, Murray said ECISD serves between 1,200 and 1,300 four-year-olds. The district thought it would be closer to 1,700 or 1,800 students. We anticipate right now about 1,000 three-year-old students entering pre-K next year, he said. On the calendar front, Murray said three calendar options for the 2021-22 school year are up on the ECISD website for public comment. We'll take that feedback to our Board of Trustees so we can make a final decision on the 21-22 school year. Murray noted that the year will be extended like this year with 180 instructional days. He noted that Sunday is the deadline to pick a school of choice. We have many schools in ECISD, elementary and high schools, that provide really exciting choices and options for our families, and that window for our families to choose a school that they are not zoned to. If you are interested in exploring one of those choices, you have until Sunday of this week to complete the choice application, he said. MCH asks public to pre-register for vaccine, by Federico Martinez. Medical Center hospital officials are encouraging the public to visit the hospital's website beginning today to start pre-registering for the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine, which is expected to arrive Monday. The hospital is expected to receive its first weekly shipment of 3,900 doses of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine Monday and begin administering shots on the same day, MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin said during a virtual Thursday press conference with other local healthcare officials. Tippin said details of how the mass vaccination will proceed are still being worked out, but the hospital will post more details throughout the weekend. MCH and the City of Odessa are collaborating on the vaccination effort, Tippin said. MCH Chief Nursing Officer Kristen Abbott-Timmons said a website link will be accessible for people today to pre-register by inputting information that will be needed to receive the vaccine. The pre-registration will not allow people to schedule a vaccine appointment, Abbott-Timmons said. The hospital's vaccination will be on a walk-in, first-come basis. The registration is an information-gathering process so that we don't have to register them on-site, Abbott-Timmons said. Pre-registering will help things go faster. Tippin said the bulk of vaccinations will be given at Ratliff Stadium, which can accommodate large groups of people safely. Vaccinations will also be offered at hospitals like Odessa Regional Medical Center, at various clinics located in Ector and Midland counties, and throughout the region. Those details are also still being worked out, Tippin said. MCH, 2 weeks ago, received a shipment of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine, which was used to vaccinate frontline healthcare workers. The hospital had enough vaccine left over to start vaccinating people in the 1B category, which includes people considered high risk for the virus. The initial Pfizer vaccine shipments will be used to continue those efforts before offering shots to the general public, Tippin said. Thursday, MCH flew the Texas flag at half-staff in honor of longtime employee Joe Guerra, an EKG tech who died January 3rd from COVID-19 complications. He was employed by MCH for more than 32 years. Joe was one of those familiar faces that was synonymous with Medical Center Hospital, Tippin said. Everyone who worked with him can speak to how Joe made MCH a better place. He was a hard-working man who loved his family, his job, and his co-workers. This tribute is only but a small fraction of the recognition Joe deserves for a life dedicated to helping others. MCH Thursday reported 77 COVID patients in-house, 7 in critical care, and 15 on ventilators. ORMC reported 23 COVID-19 patients currently hospitalized, 13 in intensive care, and 4 on ventilators. Abbott-Timmons also announced that beginning Monday, the hospital will begin allowing the public to visit non-COVID patients. on the net, mchodessa.com. OC student wins spring starter kit. Odessa College student Damaris Carrillo took home a laptop and a free year of Wi-Fi Thursday, thanks to CBS 7 and the college. Vice President for Student Services Kim McKay said this is the first year the Spring Starter Kit has been offered. It was especially important for us to make sure that students who wanted to register had an opportunity to have really solid tools to access our learning management system, and it was a fun way to get students to register early, make sure they had a schedule, and made payment arrangements, and were prepared for the first class day, McKay said. She added that she thinks it helped boost registration numbers. Since we announced the actual giveaway in early December, we had 1,000 students register before the deadline, so I think it may have played a small part in incentivizing students to register early, McKay said. Who wouldn't want a free laptop and free Wi-Fi for a year? CBS 7 sponsored the laptop, which was presented by anchor Matthew Alvarez. A Permian High School graduate, Carrillo is aiming to get into the radiologic technology program at OC. She's just about done with her prerequisites. Honestly, I'm so excited, Carrillo said. I've never won anything before. She added that it would help her finish her schooling. She is taking online and in-person classes and said the laptop will be a big help for her online courses. While she doesn't have any family in the medical field, Carrillo said the radiologic technology program sounded interesting to her. She noted that it is easier to keep her education going rather than taking a break because you forget things if you stop going to school, so it's better to get it done. McKay said the radiologic technology program lasts a little over 60 hours, so students can complete it in a 2-year time frame. She added that it is a selective admissions process, so students have to meet some prerequisites, which is what Carrillo is doing right now. Once they meet the prerequisites and are selected into the program, they are learning in a state-of-the-art facility that was remodeled 1 to 2 years ago. So they have the latest and greatest radiologic tech equipment to learn and grow on, McKay said. Carrillo acknowledged that the radiologic technology program is rigorous, but she's confident she'll get through it. I feel great. I'm looking forward to it. I know I can do this and be a radiologist, she said. McKay said OC is pleased to be able to provide these tools for students. We're fortunate to have an administration that supports students where they are and is committed to being innovative and making sure that students understand that there are learning options available for them at any time, whether it's online or on campus. So we're excited about this opportunity and appreciate that the community and the students get behind us, McKay said. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Ector County numbers are not updated daily. ECISD daily cases, 11 students, 3 staff. U.S. cases, 22,965,957 total confirmed and 383,351 deaths. Find out more at dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. See the ECISD COVID-19 dashboard at tinyurl.com/Y6NTPTUQ. COVID-19 vaccines. Medical Center Hospital will receive its first weekly shipment of 3,900 doses of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine Monday and begin administering shots on the same day. An online registration link is coming soon to sign up for the vaccine. For more information, visit tinyurl.com/Y3SXD3TO. Odessa Regional Medical Center, 520 East 6th, is expecting COVID-19 vaccines soon. The vaccine is free of charge while supplies last. Please check on vaccine availability. For more information, call 432-582-8549 or visit tinyurl.com/Y3JQHZ89. Walgreens is currently delivering vaccinations to long-term care facilities and will have vaccines for the public sometime in 2021. For more updates or information, visit tinyurl.com/Y3LNWU83. HEB has requested more COVID-19 vaccine from the state of Texas. Once they have vaccine, eligible customers can sign up using the schedule to receive a COVID-19 vaccine at no cost. To sign up, updates, or information, visit vaccine.heb.com. The CVS stores will soon have the no-cost COVID-19 vaccine available. They will administer in a phased approach based on state guidelines when available to pharmacies. For updates or information, visit tinyurl.com/Y508QJE4. Petroleum Hall of Fame 2021 inductees announced. Midland. The Petroleum Hall of Fame is dedicated to those who cherished the freedom to dare and whose work and service helped build the Permian Basin. The Petroleum Museum's Hall of Fame committee is pleased to announce the 2021 Petroleum Hall of Fame inductees: Frank M. Late, Paul L. Morris, and Fred M. Newman. The Petroleum Hall of Fame is composed of 148 members, including some of the most influential men and women in the history of the petroleum industry, such as former Presidents George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, Earl P. Halliburton, George P. Mitchell, and former U.S. Secretary of Commerce Donald Evans. Industry leaders of today's Permian Basin inducted into the Hall of Fame include State Representative Tom Craddock, Tim Leach, Scott Sheffield, Curtis Mewburn, and Jim Henry. The Petroleum Hall of Fame was instituted in October 1967 by the authority of the Charter of the Permian Basin Petroleum Museum to honor those persons and firms who have made outstanding contributions to the development of the petroleum industry or have served as worthy examples to those in the petroleum industry, and thereby to record such examples of service, strength of character, and achievement for the inspiration and education of present and future generations. Each of the 2021 inductees have distinguished themselves with their accomplishments and their leadership. They have served as admirable examples to those in both their community and the petroleum industry. To be inducted into the Petroleum Museum Hall of Fame is an honor that is second to none in the oil and gas industry. This recognition by one's peers is a worthy Hall of Fame candidate, as a worthy Hall of Fame candidate, is a testament to the achievements of these men. John L. Kennedy, Chairman of the Hall of Fame Committee of the Petroleum Museum Board of Trustees, said. The induction ceremony and dinner will be held April 29th at the Bush Convention Center. To learn more about the 2021 inductees, go to www.pbpetro.org. For more information about the event, contact Lou Ann Thornton at lthornton@petroleummuseum.org or phone 432-683-4403. About the Petroleum Museum. The Permian Basin Petroleum Museum was founded in 1975 by over 500 community leaders under the leadership of George T. Abel. The museum is one of the largest in the country dedicated to the petroleum industry and its pioneers, and has expanded its offering to include a transportation wing, featuring the world-renowned Chaparral Car Gallery, as well as one of the state's largest mineral galleries. Through education, technology, and community leadership, the Petroleum Museum continues to serve the Permian Basin community as an evolving resource for the petroleum industry and honors the individuals who have helped create its rich history. Ector County residents advised to boil water. The Texas Commission on Environmental Quality has required the Ector County Utility District to notify all customers within an area of West Odessa to boil their water prior to consumption. The notification was issued after a main break caused a loss of system pressure. Consumption of the water includes drinking, cooking, brushing teeth, making ice, and washing dishes. A map of the area in West Odessa can be found at tinyurl.com/y4z7jg22. The water should be brought to a vigorous rolling boil and then boiled for 2 minutes, a press release from ECUSUD detailed. Individuals may purchase bottled water or obtain water from some other suitable source for drinking water or human consumption purposes. Public water system officials will reportedly notify customers when the water is safe for drinking water or human consumption purposes. The public water system will also issue a notice to customers to rescind the boil water notice. Anyone with questions about the boil water notice can contact ECUD at 432-381-5525.
Odessa American Opinion Page, Friday, January 15th. National View. Big Tech's power over speech is concerning. The point, we've ceded too much power to shape the free and open internet to a handful of companies. Thanks to the First Amendment, government in the United States has little power to stop people from speaking their minds. But the Bill of Rights doesn't constrain Facebook, Twitter, and other big tech companies, which decided in the wake of last week's attack on the U.S. Capitol that the world has heard enough from President Trump. On one level, it's understandable that private companies would not want their services and platforms used to foment violence and undermine democracy. On another, their actions show just how much power over global speech we've ceded to a handful of companies whose primary incentive is profit, not free expression. The simple fact that they have such power may be more troubling than what they're doing with it. Trump crossed a bright line when he started using social media networks, not just to bemoan the results of the 2020 election, but to try to overturn them. Having spent 2 months spouting an endless stream of false allegations about a stolen election, he summoned his followers to Washington, D.C. to pressure lawmakers to throw out the certified votes of the state's electors. And after they stormed the Capitol, he called them great patriots on Twitter and urged them to go home with love. On Thursday, Facebook banned Trump indefinitely, according to Chief Executive Mark Zuckerberg, because we believe the risks of allowing the president to continue to use our service during this period are simply too great. Other networks took similar steps, with Twitter suspending his account permanently on Friday. Twitter's explanation for its action was laudably detailed. The company looked beyond what Trump was tweeting to see how his words were being interpreted online. And it found that Trump's seemingly conciliatory words were being interpreted in some quarters as an invitation for more violence, perhaps as early as next week. It was an impressive and disturbing bit of forensics that justified sidelining Trump for at least until his followers' energy dissipates. Nevertheless, big tech's shift from amplifying the president's comments to censoring them opens a Pandora's box. As Emma Yonzo of the Center for Democracy and Technology noted, there's an awful lot of politically motivated violence around the world. Do we want companies to be really on the watch for potential incitements to violence by political leaders? Yonzo asked. The answer is that we want them to respond quickly when the connection between words and deeds is clear, as was the case last week, and to explain themselves fully. But most of the time, the circumstances will be murkier. Moderating a network is hard, and when the user is a major public figure whose utterances are newsworthy, the job is that much harder. The most we can expect is that the companies impose the same rules on presidents that they do on peons and take a hard line against harassing, defamatory, or injurious speech by any user. There's a bipartisan push in Washington to reconsider the latitude online companies have to moderate their own networks, and the events of last week could make lawmakers more receptive to some ham-handed and counterproductive proposals that have been circulating. We continue to believe that it's better to have tech companies police themselves than to have the government tell them how to do it. But part of the problem is that these platforms appear too big to be moderated effectively. More competition would help matters by reducing the size and power of these dominant networks. The crackdown on Trump extended over the weekend to Parler, a social messaging service popular with conservatives that bills itself as free expression without violence and no censorship. Google and Apple removed Parler from their app stores, and Amazon cut off its bandwidth, all ostensibly because they didn't approve of the way Parler policed its network. Again, that's understandable, given that some members of last week's mob reportedly used Parler to organize and promote the violent takeover. Such comments are seditious and horrifying. But in squelching Parler, big tech is muzzling all of its users, not just the ones plotting insurrection. And as Parler noted in an antitrust lawsuit it filed against Amazon, Twitter has seen plenty of tweets threatening violence recently, yet no one is threatening to pull the plug on Twitter. Parler insists that it doesn't tolerate threats or incitement to violence and that it's no worse at enforcing its rules than any other social network is. Clearly, it needs to do a better job than it has, but the idea of big tech gatekeepers deciding how other companies should police their networks is troubling. Simply put, it grants those companies too much power to shape the free and open internet in the name of excluding unwelcome guests. Column by the Los Angeles Times.
Obituaries for Friday, January 15th. Frederick Leon Freddie Stanford, San Angelo. Frederick Leon Stanford of Kermit, died January 11th at the age of 78. He was born January 12th, 1943 in Arkadelphia, Arkansas, to Bill and Bertie Lee Dodd Stanford. He married Isla Ray Layton in 1962, and he lived most of his married life in Odessa. He is survived by his wife, Isla Ray Layton Stanford, two children, Pamela Denise Stanford Glander and Frederick Blake Stanford, daughter-in-law Melanie Carol Taylor Stanford, six grandchildren, four great-grandchildren, his brother Robert Lee Stanford and wife Sue, sister-in-law Patsy Layton, as well as several nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his brother Billy Stanford, sister-in-law Gyneth Layton Stanford, son-in-law Michael Glander, and his favorite dog, Zandy. Services will be held January 16th at 2 p.m. at Harper's Funeral Home in San Angelo. In lieu of flowers, please make donations to the Michael J. Fox Foundation, Help Speed a Parkinson's Cure. https://www.michaeljfox.org/donate. Family and friends can share online condolences at www.harper-funeral-home.com. William Lamar Knighton. William Lamar Bill Knighton passed away January 9th after a brief illness. Bill was born August 24th, 1929, in Amity, Arkansas, to William and Evie Knighton. He is survived by his wife of 30 years, Martha Knighton, his children, Alan and wife Patricia Knighton of Albuquerque, New Mexico, Margaret and husband Ron Leach, James and husband Jackie Knighton, and Brian and wife Jeannie Knighton, all of Odessa, stepsons Miguel Marquez and Abel Marquez Sr., brother Larry Knighton, 9 grandchildren, and numerous nieces, nephews, in-laws, and great-grandchildren. A viewing with COVID-19 protocols in place will be held Saturday, January 16th at 11 a.m., till 4 p.m. at First Assembly of God Church in Odessa. A celebration of life memorial service is planned for a future date. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made in his honor to Operation Smile, https://www.operationsmile.org, or by phone at 1-888-249-3797. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. To send condolences to the family, please sign his guestbook at www.sunsetodessa.com. Wayne Woody. Wayne Woody passed away January 9th in Odessa at the age of 87. He was born February 22nd, 1933, in Murphy, North Carolina, the oldest of 10 children born to Hosea and Edna Woody of North Carolina. He married Lillian Hageman in 1955, and they were married 65 years. He is survived by his wife, Lillian, 5 children and their spouses, siblings, as well as several grand and great-grandchildren. Funeral arrangements are being made by the Purchase Funeral Choices in Odessa. Viewing will be held at Cornerstone Worship Center in Odessa, Friday, January 15th, from 5 to 7 p.m. A funeral service will be held at the same location Saturday, January 16th at 10 a.m. with Reverend Timothy Woody and Reverend Paul Thompson providing. Graveside and burial will follow at the Monahans Memorial Cemetery. William Lyle Gardner. Funeral services for William Lyle Gardner, 59, of Denver City, will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, January 16th, in the Dag Azam Sports Complex of Denver City, with the Reverend Kyle Struhn officiating under the direction of Ratliff Funeral Home of Denver City. William passed away Thursday, January 7th, in Lubbock. He was born February 17th, 1961, in Odessa, to Butch and Helen Gardner. He married Teresa Wingrove in 1980 in Odessa. William was preceded in death by his brother, James Allen Gardner. He is survived by his wife, Teresa Gardner, of the home, 2 daughters, Melissa Taylor and her husband, Ryan of Andrews, Christina Burkhart and her husband, Eric of Midland, his in-laws, James and Joanne Wingrove, 5 grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren, a brother, Paul Gardner, and his wife, Michelle, along with other extended family members. Visitation will be held Friday, January 15th from 6 to 8 p.m. in the Ratliff Funeral Home Chapel. Death Notices. Betty Sue Garrison Talley. Betty Sue Talley, 85, of Odessa, died Tuesday, January 12th. A graveside service will be held at 3 p.m. January 18th at Sunset Memorial Gardens, with Reverend Dr. Jimmy Braswell officiating. Vivian S. Godfather Reyes. Vivian S. Godfather Reyes, 70, of Odessa, died Thursday, January 7th. Mass will be celebrated at 12 noon, Saturday, January 16th, at Holy Redeemer Catholic Church, with Father Fernando Bonilla officiating. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Miguel Rubio Hernandez. Miguel Rubio Hernandez, 61, of Odessa, died Thursday, January 7th. Funeral service will be held at 12:30 p.m. Tuesday, January 19th at Iglesia del Camino. Burial will follow at Ector County Cemetery. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Abel D. Castro. Abel D. Castro, 70, of Kermit, died Monday, December 28th in Lubbock. Services will be scheduled at a later date. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.